From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, how to read a book.
I read a lot, not just magazines, but other more serious things.
There is careful reading, reading slowly, in order to understand thoroughly each idea expressed by the writer.
When we do slow down, when we let ourselves be immersed in, be absorbed by the experience of reading, we really do learn something about ourselves.
I could learn every line of Crime and Punishment by heart and recite it to you.
Some books rev you up, some are uppers and some are downers, and some still you and some put you into a contemplative state. It's a powerful thing.
Chapter 1, you didn't really get along. Chapter 2, I think I fell in love with you.
He thought it would be a great idea to do a novel that unfolded in the margins of another novel.
How to read a book sounds like a pretty short show, doesn't it? You already know how to read a book. Or do you? The truth is, a lot of the reading you and I do these days is on a screen, and screen reading is all about speed. In this hour, the case for slow reading. Also, how exactly do you read a novel that is in the margins of another novel? J.J. Abrams, the man behind the TV show Lost, invents a new kind of book. And the origins of social media, not Facebook, not Twitter, papyrus scrolls in ancient Rome. But first, meet one of the guys who changed the way we read, Jason Murkowski. He helped develop Amazon's Kindle e-reader. He's also the author of Burning the Page, The E-Book Revolution, and The Future of Reading. Jason, near the beginning of your book, you write that you think we've made a pact with the devil in digitizing our words. What do you mean by that?
That's a great question, Jim. When you look at what we're doing with digital content now, whether it's ebooks or videos, music, there is a sense that books are not these austere objects that go on mahogany bookshelves with gilt and leather embossed bindings anymore. And in a way, by digitizing our content and making it available on devices like the Kindle and other e-readers, we've done a great service by making content available and hopefully increasing readership. I'd like to think there's a minor renaissance going on now in reading because content's available now and perhaps more cheaply than ever was, with that much more ease than ever before. At the same time, though, I feel this easy accessibility to content might be perceived as a way of cheapening the content, and having books on the pedestal that they once were may not fly anymore, given that they're being treated in some ways as just media, like videos and music and every other kind of digital content.
You sound like a man who loves having a physical book in your hand.
I do. I was one of the early adopters of Kindle, of course, having a Kindle before anyone did, and I felt like, wow, I'm using an iPod years before anyone has an iPod, and I get to feel like an early innovator with my first Kindle out in the streets. But these days, I find myself more often, paradoxically, just with a good old-fashioned book. I like the heft of a book. I like sometimes even the smell of a book. You know, there are subtle variations. I tend not to like the ones that smell like fish. The ink sometimes is very reminiscent of just the primality of the book. But ultimately, I think anything is good, whether it's print or digital. I don't think there's any barrier to reading as long as a book immerses you inside its subject.
What was it like to work with Bezos? There's a former Amazon engineer who said that he's such a control freak, he makes ordinary control freaks look like stoned hippies. What do you think of that?
I think it's probably the best thing that ever happened to product development, that there are people like Steve Jobs and Jeff who really care about product development and are such control freaks that we now have great devices like iPhones and Mac computers and Amazon instant ordering and Prime subscriptions. Yes, there's a relentless dedication to doing things right, but what I admire most about Jeff is it's done from a perspective of data, and Amazon has what I would call maybe an IQocracy. There's no such word, but everyone was sort of on equal footing in a meeting with Jeff. As long as you had the right data and could back up your assertions with facts, and you weren't just sort of blue-skying it and pontificating. There was no real appreciation of just opinions at Amazon. Everything had to be backed up by fact and ideally customer complaints or feedback from customers. And I think that's the right way to run a company when it comes to creating product.
What was the most challenging part, do you think, of those days, in the early days of the Kindle, getting it up and making it work and putting it out in front of the public?
I guess we were all worried whether it would work. A number of people, organizations had tried to do e-reading. Microsoft tried in 2001. And there were some wonderful, hefty, brick-like devices like the Rocket Reader, which some of your listeners may have once used, that were popular back in 2000. For whatever reason, none of these devices ever took off, and the ebook ecosystem faltered every time one of these organizations would try releasing a product. And so our biggest worry would be, would we sell ebooks? Would we sell Kindles? When we finally launched, we were really pleased to sell out within a couple hours. We were all in a big launch room cheering down as the countdown of inventory dwindled down to zero, and we let off a wonderful hurrah because market pressures showed that, you know, we didn't even have enough to meet demand based on our most optimistic expectations. So it turns out that fear was unnecessary. But there was a lot of fear about, you know, we're spending years of our lives, millions upon millions of dollars, creating this new e-reading system. Will people like to read digitally?
Yeah. You say in this new book, Burning the Page, that you think we're on the threshold of reading 2.0. What do you mean by reading 2.0?
Right. Great question, Jim. So in Silicon Valley, we have this sense of giving version numbers to products. So version 1 of a product might be version 1.0, and version 2 we'd call version 2.0. And usually between version 1 and 2, there's a major seismic shift in the experience of the product. For the last couple hundred years, reading as we know it has been a very linear form where you read from front to back or in certain languages back to front, but it's linear, right? You don't really skip around and you don't really interact with a book. It's a learning process which is self-paced. But what I've seen with the way that publishers have changed around ebooks is it's all up for grabs now, and we're seeing features like non-linearity. So, for example, it becomes a lot easier to search inside an ebook for the content you want. You don't just go to an index at the back of the book, find the first time some topic is mentioned, and flip to it. You just search right there in the book, and it takes you to the page that might be of interest to you. We're seeing analytics right inside books. And look, with a print book, a publisher typically has no idea who buys the book, let alone how far through the book they get or what their experience is or whether they recommend the book to friends. But with digital books now, we're able to track this data and see that my mom got this book and recommended it to my aunt, who in turn read 5 chapters through and blah, 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 blah. So the way we read is no longer solitary and linear. Everything has changed. It's nonlinear. It's shared. It's social. And so smarter publishers are coming up with new features based on these Reading 2.0 enhancements to really engage people in a new way.
I was thinking about the act of reading. It has been a solitary pleasure for many people for many years. At the same time, it's also a very social activity because one of the pleasures of reading is sharing a discussion, a conversation about the content of the book with others. In some ways, the ebook enhances that. And if I understand your notion of what reading is going to become, Reading 2 or 3 or 4.0, it will be even more that way. In fact, I'm curious about this thing you've kind of described as the Facebook for books.
Yeah, and to me, there's no reason why all of our books shouldn't be linked together. When you look at human culture, we have 35 million books in print, and that's a lot of books. And there are conversations that happen between books. It's not just in the bibliographies of a given reference work where it points to other books. Even within fiction books, there are sometimes subtle, sometimes explicit references to other books. And what I would really like to see is this concept of a Facebook for books. Imagine a buffet of content, all these books that you can just hop to like you can from one Netflix film to another, where contextually within one book you can link out to something that's very similar based on subject matter or other things the author has written about or things that other people themselves have commented on. There's a great conversation that happens on the web as we put our web pages up and Google indexes them and we can find content and we as readers can learn. But in a way, books are still locked off in this shadowy gray realm where they can't communicate with us in quite the same way. And they're treated as second-class citizens and can't inform each other the way that we would like, perhaps, to really find and ferret out the nuances in the details of a book. And so when I speak of Reading 2.0 and the Facebook for Books, that's my vision for it.
Putting them all together so that you can find pieces of one, but at the same time, the downside might be that you start reading Moby Dick, and a lot of people have trouble reading Moby Dick, and they get a little interested in whaling, and they go off and find a book on whaling, and that takes them to a book on the life of sharks, and they go off and read that, and they never come back.
I think Herman Melville would approve. If you read Moby Dick, there are so many interstitial chapters which seem to go on for incredibly long tangents which have nothing to do with the plot. It's encyclopedic, and whether he's talking about cephalopods or whales and just going off on these elaborate catalogs of where they were once sighted, off of which oceans, and what you can do with a whale jaw, it has nothing to do with the plot of Captain Ahab, but yet we're sucked into it because we're learning and we like that encyclopedism. And so I think there's some works that would be less appropriate for. But if the goal of reading is to grow and we're able to learn from content and having these books networked together helps that, I'm all for it.
Jason Murkowski is the author of Burning the Page, The Ebook Revolution, and The Future of Reading. One of the great pleasures of reading is the experience of sinking so deeply into the world of a book that it becomes more real than the real world. Today, that kind of reading is increasingly a luxury. In our hyper-connected, always-on world of endless information, we're all skimming and skipping and browsing just to keep up. Literary scholar David Mikics worries that reading deeply is becoming a bit of a lost art. So he's written a book to remind us how. It's called Slow Reading in a Hurried Age. Anne Strainchamps talks with him.
David, slow reading calls to mind the slow food and the slow travel movements. How do you make the case for slow reading?
One of the great theorists of reading, one of the great wise men about reading, was John Ruskin. And in the 19th century, he warns us against what he describes as, and I'm quoting, shallow, blotching, blundering, infectious information. So Ruskin's point, rather aggressively made, is that if you read for information or just for information, then you'll be reading too quickly. You're just reading to get the gist of things, just to sort of skim and skip and get the basic point. You're not really entering into a book. You're not seeing what the author of the book has to offer you. You have to try to learn to think along with the author, to think along with the characters, and to really immerse yourself in it. And to do that, it's important to slow down.
You come up with a number of rules or guidelines for slow reading. So let's talk about a few of them. One of the first is be patient. What do you mean by that?
What I want people to do is be patient with themselves. If they try a book and after the first couple of pages, they find themselves frustrated. They think, oh, this is not for me. It's too difficult, too unappealing. Well, yes, you can set it aside, but try it again later. Give yourself another chance. There's been a number of times when I've had that feeling myself. I've thought, well, I'm not in the mood for this. This seems to me too difficult, too serious, or too light, too trivial. And later on, I found it just right. So many times I've come to a book for the third time or even the fourth time and then loved it. So that's one sense of being patient. Another sense is realizing that a book has many folds in it. It has a lot of richness, a good book, and that you'll learn more when you come back to it a second time. Rereading is another of my recommended practices.
Really? In this world of so many great books to read, you advocate rereading?
I think that everyone, Anne, should have a short shelf of favorite books. A shelf of books that you can dip into just when you're in the mood, when you have the feeling that you want to return to one of these old favorites. And the more you do that, the more you really sense that they are old friends, that you keep coming back to them.
An interesting debate cropped up recently online, a debate between writers, about whether characters in a novel should be likable, or at least somewhat likable. And we've all had experience of reading a novel and thinking, I just can't stand these people. Does slow reading change the way you approach the characters in a novel?
Well, it does. I think it gives you a wonderful sense of those writers who can make truly interesting characters, truly deep characters. And even when you feel, oh, I dislike that character so much, I just can't stand him or her, if you really give enough attention to the character, then you do see more. You see more. You see why the author did it. I'll give you one example. In Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, Anna's lover, Vronsky, is perhaps the shallowest, the least attractive character in the book.
He's a cad.
He is a cad. He is. There's no getting around that. And it remains hard to see what Anna sees in him, why she's so drawn to him, you know, why she is so head over heels in love with him. And it tells us something important about Anna, though, that she is attracted to him so much. There's something about herself she doesn't know that causes her to have this magnetic bond with Vronsky. But Vronsky himself, too, is more complicated than you might have thought. You know, you have to get over your initial response of, oh, what a jerk, and start thinking about, well, what an interesting jerk he is. You know, there are so many folds to that character.
Do you read for self-discovery? That is, when you read, are you really searching for some new insights into yourself?
Well, that's a very important question, Anne, and I think that I do. I think that all of us do. When we do slow down, when we let ourselves be immersed in, be absorbed by the experience of reading, we really do learn something about ourselves. And it may be hard to define what we learn, but we do have that sense that somehow our lives are enriched. In part, they're enriched by just considering more characters, more other lives than we would ever have time to do in life. We meet more people reading literature than we have time to do during our lives.
So do you think a slow reading movement has much chance of catching on in this age of digital distraction?
I think that there's a revolt on our hands, and it's a good revolt. People are widely dissatisfied with this regimen of constant electronic stimulation that we've been given. And with all the freedom that the internet promises, you can go here, you can go there, you can look at this, you can look at that, all you need to do is click and you can see something new. I think people are frustrated with that just because of the kind of broken rhythm that it imposes upon us. The thing that we really want to do is devote ourselves to something, devote ourselves to an experience, whether it's reading or anything else. And reading is one of the richest experiences you can have. I just finished the new Dave Eggers novel, The Circle. It's a dystopia about an internet company, which imposes this sort of constant bombardment of stimulation on its employees. At every moment, they have to like this or like that, or answer this survey, answer that survey, friend one another, keep in touch with everything.
That sounds like life today.
Exactly. It's hardly a futuristic vision. At one point, the main character gets in trouble for going to lunch for 20 minutes without her cell phone. But of course, this is something that happens now. We're not being given that refuge. We're not being given the possibility of escaping and looking into ourselves and looking into a book. We're always expected to be in touch, to be able to answer at any moment. And this is, I think, something new. It's something that's happened in the last 10 years or so. And it's a disturbing phenomenon, something that we have to counteract. But I do think that a lot of people want to do that. They want something different in their lives.
So your message is readers revolt.
Exactly. Yes. Rise up. You have nothing to lose but your electronic chains.
Well, David, I think a great way to end our conversation would be to ask you to read the last paragraph of your book.
Thanks. I would love to do that. Emerson yearned after books which take rank in our life, with parents and lovers and passionate experiences. And Kafka noted in a letter to his friend Oscar Pollock that some books seem like a key to unfamiliar rooms in one's own castle. When we read, we want a book that will unlock us, even break us open. In reading, as Harold Bloom suggests, we quest after something more original than ourselves, new experience, a radical break from what we know too well. This newness finds its place in us and makes us rise to embrace it. It becomes part of us, something we can always return to by the simple act of picking up the book again. Today more than ever, we find ourselves frustrated by the shallow promises of digital technology, as it offers ever more rapid, more ingenious, and more unsatisfying ways of keeping in touch. Instead of staying up to the minute, we should step back, and think about what Virginia Woolf, like so many others, celebrates, the rewards of slow reading. Getting lost in a book may be the surest way to find what we need.
David, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you very much, Anne. Pleasure to be here.
David Mikics is the author of Slow Reading in a Hurried Age. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps.
This is the first poem in my new collection called Aimless Love.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate, Billy Collins.
And the title of the poem is Reader. Looker, gazer, skimmer, skipper, thumb-licking page-turner, peruser, you getting your print fix for the day, pencil chewer, note-taker, marginalianist with your checks and X's, first-timer or revisitor, browser, speedster, English major, flight-ready girl, melancholy boy, invisible companion, thief, blind date, perfect stranger. That is me rushing to the window to see if it's you passing under the shade trees with a baby carriage or a dog on a leash. Me picking up the phone to imagine your unimaginable number. Me standing by a map of the world, wondering where you are, alone on a bench in a train station, or falling asleep, the book sliding to the floor.
Billy Collins, reading from his new collection of poems, Aimless Love. What about you? Are you an e-reader fan? Or do you still prefer to cozy up with a good old analog physical book? You can email us online at ttbook.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Coming up, anxious, depressed, coming down with the flu, you need a dose of bibliotherapy. And the mysterious literary universe of S, a novel that unfolds in the margins of another novel. As we continue our How to Read a Book, I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Exhausted, depressed, hungover, still reeling from that thing your ex-friend said last night, maybe you need a dose of bibliotherapy. For the past few years, Eliber Thu and Susan Elderkin have steered their clients through heartbreak, despair, and the common cold with personalized prescriptions for reading. Now they've gathered their best literary remedies together in a compendium called The Novel Cure, and Strainchamps reached them.
Susan and Ella, how did you come up with the concept of bibliotherapy?
Well, we were very fortunate to be in adjacent bedrooms when we went to Downing College, Cambridge, together at the same time. And we both rapidly realized that we had a huge shared love of books. And whenever the other person was having a life problem or a love problem or a work problem, we would give each other a book that would sort them out. And we realized that it had genuine curative powers by seeing how the other one reacted to our cures.
Susan, do you remember one of the first books that Ella ever gave you?
Well, one which I feel has had a lasting effect was Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway as a kind of get-up-and-go book in the morning, because it's a really rousing, you know, get up in the morning, buy flowers, get out on the street, smell the air. And it works on me still, actually. I still dip into it for
that. It worked so well for Suze that she joined the rowing team and used to get up at six in the morning and go rowing. It was a bit extreme, actually. I almost wished I hadn't.
You can't decide whether Virginia Woolf would have been pleased or horrified.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's important to remember that there are many reasons to read a book, but it's impossible to ignore the fact that the rhythm of the book or the underlying messages that come through in a book can be really transformative. And, you know, we've all experienced that sense of having read the perfect novel at exactly the right moment in our lives, that it's mm-hmm. really changed our perspective.
Mm. Mm. Now, the two of you have now spent years as bibliotherapists. How does that work in practice?
We start off by sending a questionnaire by email to the prospective client, and the questionnaire asks about their reading life, what they read, why they read, where they read, how they read. And it also asks them questions about events in their life, like are there any problems going on at the moment, and where are they in their career? Are they about to move house or change job or retire? Or, you know, is there any big thing happening? And we then prescribe them, so to speak, a collection of books which are going to be the perfect books for them to read, we hope, at that point in their life. And then we do follow-up sessions later on as well.
Mm. So, Susan, for example, you've organized your book from A to Z. So let's start with A, and let's say somebody comes to see you with the classic modern complaint, anxiety. What do you prescribe?
Well, there's several ways of dealing with that one. I mean, one thing to do is to give them a book which is written in a style which slows the heart rate down. And one of my favorite books for that actually is Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway.
What about it slows the heart rate down?
There's a rhythm as we read that starts a sort of pendulum effect in our head. Some books rev you up, some are uppers and some are downers, and some still you and some put you into a contemplative state. So something else we use in the book is Henry James. Henry James writes in rather wonderfully laborious sentences. Some people love him, some people hate him.
There are many who feel that Henry James would be a wonderful cure for insomnia.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Now, what about, I don't know, more serious mental issues, depression, for instance?
Well, that is a really big one. We come at it from two different angles. There's the major one, which is for people that are really depressed. They should read very serious books that through which you can understand your own depression and see it reflected in other people and realize that you're not alone. So, for instance, we got The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath, who did become extremely depressed and unfortunately ended up committing suicide. So she is someone that really did know about depression.
Susan, what's the rationale for prescribing something very depressing to somebody who's already depressed?
It surprised us as well, to be honest. But what started to be fed back to us was that people who are very, very seriously depressed can't be knocked out of it, you know, that easily with a chivying sort of read, to boost their spirits. It's something very much more serious than that. And what seems to work for people is a sense that you're not alone and that there's somebody else who can hold your hand in that dark place. We found that many people who suffered from serious depression had those books near them at all times as sort of Bibles of to take down into that dark place and know that they were not going mad and that other people had been there before. And you know, as Ella said, some of the authors that we've used are people who did not survive their illness of depression. But I think we both see it as their gift to those that have come after, that maybe their experience can make somebody else feel not so alone and therefore know that they can get help and things can get better.
Mm. Now, what about actual physical illness? Say, you know, the flu or the common cold. You're stuck at home with a stuffy nose and a cough and a headache. What are the best books for a common cold?
For the common cold, we admit that there is no novel that can cure your cold. So we provide the 10 best books to read on a duvet day, so to speak. basically cheering up books, which are just going to be great, light, and possibly quite addictive reads that you can sniff into your hanky while you're reading.
These sound like things to keep on your short shelf. What are they?
Absolutely. Well, we've got The Lost Art of Keeping Secrets by Eva Rice in there. We've got The Secret Life of Bees by Sue Monk-Kidd. We put a few children's books in the books. We really believe that adults can get a lot from returning to much-loved children's books. We've got Comet in Moominland by Tove Jansson in there. We've got The Devil Wears Prada by Lauren Weisenberger. So, you know, things which don't require too much effort.
What about books to help people deal with the really difficult things that happen in life? The death of a very close family member, for instance. There's one, I think you suggest, a novel by John Berger.
Yes, that's one of, I think, five novels we suggest for that ailment. It's probably one of the very much most serious things we have in the book. And it seemed to us that people go through many different stages of grief, and we needed to address those different stages of grief. And the John Berger you mention, Here Is Where We Meet, is kind of for the final stage of grief, which is getting towards acceptance. And that's a very meditative and beautiful book in which the narrator, who is kind of John Berger himself, starts to see people who have died, his mother, his best friend, and he kind of revisits them in the places that they had lived in together and loved together. So he goes around visiting these places and refinding these dead people and having conversations with them. And it's really charming because there are things about his mother, the way she puts on her lipstick, for instance, which still irritate him, even though she's dead, and he's so pleased to see her. So he learns to re-see her in a sort of wholehearted way. He remembers what was bad about her as well as what was wonderful about her, and puts her story to rest in a way.
And what is it you think reading that book would do for someone who's lost somebody and is maybe getting around to the stage of acceptance?
Well, I think it just gives you some ideas of what you can do. I mean, certainly when I lost my father a couple of years ago, somebody once said to me, you know, you can still go for walks with your dad. That's something which I used to do a lot with my dad, and that's something we shared together. And I do that. You know, I sometimes go off for a walk by myself and go somewhere where my dad would have loved as well, and think about him and think of things I would have pointed out to him and he would have pointed out to me. And that has really helped me. So that book, I guess it was probably inspired by that for me.
Mm. Well, it's a wonderful service that you've invented, and one that I can imagine really taking off in libraries.
Excellent.
Thank you both so much for talking. I'm going to go home and look at my bookshelves in a completely new light.
Thank you.
Ella Berthou and Susan Elderkin are the authors of the novel Cure, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 books to cure what ails you. Producer and director J.J. Abrams is best known for his TV series, Alias and Lost, and for movies like Mission Impossible 3 and Star Trek Into Darkness. But his latest project isn't on a screen. It's a book called S. Two books, actually, or at least two novels. One is written inside the other, in the form of margin notes exchanged by two fictional characters. The book comes stuffed with postcards, old photographs, a decoder wheel, and a coffee shop napkin with a map drawn on it. Critically acclaimed novelist Doug Dorst took on the challenging task of writing S. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon spoke with him.
Doug, where did the original idea for S come from?
The idea originated with JJ. He was at LAX one evening and found a Robert Ludlum novel on a bench outside that somebody had left. Inside the book, someone had written, "Please pick me up, share me with someone else." And just that simple thing got him thinking about how people might connect in the context of a book and what an interesting relationship that might create. So JJ, being who he is, that immediately turned into what kind of amazing project can we make with that? And so he thought it would be a great idea to do a novel that unfolded in the margins of another novel.
S is truly a beautiful object, Doug. When I first opened it, I thought of Mark Danielewski's House of Leaves. You've got the postcards, the handwritten letters, the photocopies of the sheets from the journals and the telegrams, paper napkin from a cafe with a map of various tunnels. How do all of these items fit within the world of S?
We chose items that would deepen the Straka mystery and also deepen the reading experience. We knew from the beginning that we wanted to have that as an available option, that was one of the things we were going to do with this book, is open it up to materials that were outside the text and be able to incorporate them into the story. And as I was writing, I made a sort of wish list. Some detail would come up and I would think, oh, that would be an amazing thing to have a document for. And I made a wish list of all of the external documents and physical objects that I would like to have. And I decided that it was not my job to worry about feasibility or cost or anything. So I had this absurd, insane wish list. I figured it was someone else's job to tell me no.
Hmm. Let's talk a bit about the novel within the novel, Ship of Theseus by V.M. Straka. Can you give me, Doug, a brief outline without spoiling anything, but a brief outline of what happens in Ship of Theseus?
The book opens with an amnesiac character walking the streets of this vaguely threatening, gloomy old city. much of the rest of the novel revolves around the question of his trying to discover who he is, who he has been, who he will be. He gets shanghaied onto a very strange ship, and that's what takes him away from the old city and starts him on this sequence of adventures, throughout all of which there is a sort of lurking strangeness, but a sense also of forward momentum, that in order to find out who he is, he has to keep going forward with this.
Yeah. This obviously would be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from Ship of Theseus.
Sure. This is chapter one of Straka's novel. Chapter one, What Begins, What Ends. Dusk, the old quarter of a city where river meets sea. A man in a dark gray overcoat walks the quarter's streets, a tangle of cobblestone passages that spin from the harbor and thread themselves through neighborhoods where the smells of cooking spices vary, but the sad decrepitude is shared. The buildings, black with the soot of centuries, loom over him, blocking out most of the sky and making it difficult to know at any given moment whether he's heading toward the water or away from it. The man suspects this is a city in which even lifelong residents find themselves lost. He does not know whether he is such a person, though. He does not know whether he has ever been here before. He does not know why he is here now. A steady drizzle falls. The man in the overcoat passes people taking cover under awnings and overhangs, plodding forward with heads down and hats low, huddling under rags in alleyways. Though this is a city of watchful eyes, gazes wash over him and roll away. This is a man who does not attract attention. He turns a corner. A wide-hipped woman stands outside her home, a narrow brick building four stories tall and covered with a black layer of lichen. And she hangs up a sign offering rooms. She's the wife of a sea captain who left 4 years ago on a ship bound for a remote land where the hills were said to be bursting with silver, the valleys teeming with exotic fruits and game. His return is 8 months overdue, and the bank account is empty. So she's begun taking in and feeding poxy and gnat-gnawed sailors, in addition to her three ravenous sons, who are all dreaming of following their father and shipping out into the unknown. None of them yet knows that her husband's bones are lying under a mile of water, some beneath a stack of cracked timbers just off Cape Fortuna, a place they've never heard of, and some scattered for miles by pelagic scavengers. This is what happens, of course. Men get lost, men vanish, men are erased and reborn.
That was great. Thank you, Doug. Excellent reading.
Thank you.
The title, Ship of Theseus, is a reference to Plutarch's paradox, this question of whether an object which has had all its parts replaced remains fundamentally the same object. And that question is a central one throughout S, because the theme of identity is a big part of the storylines, isn't it?
It is. It's connected to the mystery of Straka, the question of, you know, who was Straka? In many authorship controversies, the Straka controversy, the Shakespeare controversy, there is the question of whether the writer could have been someone of the means of the training of the experience who could possibly have written the work that one is reading.
Mm.
So yeah, that question of who he was as a writer seemed connected to the question of who he was as a person. And it seemed like the same issues were in play for Jennifer and Eric, the two readers who are interacting in the margins.
Eric's a grad student, right, who is studying Straka, and Jen is the undergrad who discovers the book.
That's right. And Eric, he's been booted out of the program. He has crashed and burned spectacularly as a grad student. And there's a bit of bad blood between him and the professor with whom he was working, and also one of his fellow grad students. He has been into Straka, studying Straka, reading Straka since he was in high school. And now he's in his late 20s. And he's pretty much been drummed out of academia, which yeah. is really what he'd been counting on all along. And Jennifer is a college senior. She's in that position, I think, that a lot of us were. You're about to leave college and you have no idea what you want to do. And, you know, she's not sure how much of a self she even has right now.
Mm-hmm. I've been reading the novel within the novel, Ship of Theseus, along with Eric and Jen's notes to each other as I go. But I came across one reader who has decided to read the novel within the novel, Ship of Theseus, first, and then go back and read Eric and Jen's notes after. So I wonder, do you think it matters how a reader reads S?
I think it matters, but I think it matters mostly to the reader, which is to say that I think you have to find the way that's best for you. And it probably has something to do with the way we're all wired, you know, how we can absorb information. From what I've been hearing, there are radically different strategies. There are people who've read the whole book, and there are people who go chapter by chapter, read a chapter of Ship of Theseus, then go back and read the notes. And then there are people who are doing it page by page. Presumably, there are some people who are reading it all simultaneously. And I am amazed. I am humbled before someone who can pull that off, because my brain does not work that way.
When I was spending some time on your website, Doug, I discovered a link to an intriguing website that is connected with S, Radio Straka. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was a project that the UK publisher Canongate put together in advance of the launch, in which they recorded 5 hours of Straka-related pirate radio music and musings and ramblings and rantings of one particular Straka enthusiast. And it's kind of insane in the best possible way.
Hello, hello. Yes, welcome. Welcome to this Radio Straka. I'd like to welcome you. My name is not important. I would like to begin at the water with this broadcast. So, this show is about the oceans, with what we find in them, on them, over them. But first, some music.
Doug Dorst is the author of S. Emmy Award-winning filmmaker J.J. Abrams came up with the idea for the book. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon spoke with Doug Dorst. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can get in touch with us through Facebook or Twitter. You'll find links to our Facebook and Twitter accounts on our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll explore the first 2,000 years of social media as we conclude our How to Read a Book. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The Roman statesman Marcus Tullius Cicero and the German priest Martin Luther didn't have access to Facebook or Twitter, but in their day, they were masters of social media. Long before Marcus Zuckerberg was a twinkle in his mother's eye, there was media, and it was social. That's the argument Tom Standage makes in his book Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years. Standage is also the digital editor of The Economist. Steve Paulson talks with him.
Tom, you say that Martin Luther had his own version of social media in Reformation Europe. In fact, the Protestant revolt against Catholicism would not have been nearly so effective without the intervention of Gutenberg's printing press.
Indeed, he writes this list, the 95 Theses, which are the list of sort of talking points of why he thinks the Pope and the Catholic Church are wrong when it comes to the doctrine of indulgences. And this is about giving the Church money in order to get yourself or your relatives out of purgatory. Luther thinks this is all a bit dodgy, so he writes this list of reasons why he thinks it is and says, I want to have a debate about this. And he writes them in Latin, which is the language of theological debate, and he's a theologian at a university in a town called Wittenberg, and he pins this up on the university notice board, which is in fact the church door in Wittenberg, and invites the debate. And this is such explosive stuff that people start to copy it down and send it to their friends. And so some printers get hold of this and they reprint what Luther has come up with, his list. And that means that because a typical print run would be 500 or 1,000 copies, there are suddenly a lot more copies in circulation. And it spreads to other towns, and then printers there get hold of it and reprint it. So a contemporary of Luther tells us that it takes 2 weeks for Luther's list to spread throughout the whole of Germany, and only 4 weeks to spread throughout the whole of Western Western Europe. And this is astonishing to Luther. It's not what he expected at all. But he senses an opportunity, which is that evidently, if you put something out there that a lot of people agree with, but maybe they can't admit they agree with, they'll spread it on their own. So he follows up with a series of pamphlets written in German, which are much more easily understandable because they're not in theological Latin. Far more people read German, even though the rate of literacy is not all that high. And these pamphlets, he just has to give the text to one printer in his own town. He prints 1,000 copies, they spread to other towns, printers there reprint them, and so on and so on. And he does this again and again and again. And we've, you know, in the first 10 years of the Reformation, there are something like 5 to 7 million pamphlets flying around. So it's an amazingly effective way for him to spread his message and to galvanize support for the idea that the Catholic Church needed to be reformed. And ultimately, instead of being reformed, the church split. And that is the Reformation.
And you use the phrase going viral. You say Luther went viral. I mean, we tend to think of that as a very modern phenomenon. You're saying it goes way back.
Yes, my tongue is somewhat in my cheek. I've actually plotted Luther's traffic stats. The way we measure the effectiveness of a social media campaign today is, you know, how many times a tweet is retweeted or something on Facebook is liked or something on Tumblr is reblogged or something on Google Plus is plus one, etc., etc. You can actually count up the number of times that Luther was reprinted. So the number of times a printer got hold of one of his pamphlets and said, this is amazing, I'm going to reprint it and put another 1,000 copies in circulation, in effect retweeting it to the local community.
Which is interesting. I mean, you're saying that Luther himself was not the one who was making all these copies. I mean, he put out a few and then other people were copying. I mean, retweeting really is the proper analogy here.
It really is, because what's happening here is the audience is deciding what's important and amplifying it. And that's why I say this is a social media system. This is not broadcast. And the Catholic Church at the time had broadcast of a kind. It could say to its archbishops, who would say to the bishops, who would say to the local priests, you know, go into the pulpit and say that Luther is terrible. And so they did. And that was a kind of broadcast. But Luther's social distribution was much more effective. And so that's why I say it's social. It's person to person. It's people recommending it to things. It's people going to the printer and saying, have you got the new Martin Luther? It's really great. If you haven't got it, you should find it and reprint it. And then when the printer has 10 people coming to him asking for it, he realizes there's demand. So he prints it. And then when other people go to the printer when he's sold out and ask for it, the fact that there are none left tells them that other people in their town, even if they don't know them, agree with Luther. And this is what modern scholars of media call synchronization of opinion. And it's the way that social media can allow people to discover that the views that they hold, but maybe aren't prepared to announce in public, are actually widely held by other people. And that's what we saw in the Arab Spring. As Luther put it, I gather from the rapid spread of the theses, his list, what the greater part of Germany thinks about indulgences. So the rapid spread of the list told him and the people who was spreading it that his views were popular. And that's the kind of signaling that social media makes possible.
What's fascinating about this history you are laying out for us is how something different, quite different, happened than later on. I mean, you are not describing the mass media here, the institutions that we tend to know as the major newspapers, as television networks, where the news has gatekeepers and it's centralized and there are professional journalists. And that all came along, what, in the mid-19th century?
Yes, my whole point is that that's a very, very recent phenomenon. So we're used to thinking of the idea that, you know, old media, as we've been calling it, is the way media's always been. And what I'm really trying to do in this book is say, no, if you look at the last 2,000 years, media has been social for most of that period. And it's only in the middle of the 19th century that you start to get what we now think of as mass media. So essentially what happens is you get these machines that are invented, starting with the steam press in the 19th century and then the radio and TV transmitter in the 20th century. And what they do is they allow you to send the same message to a very large audience extremely cheaply, extremely conveniently, whether it's a newspaper with a very large circulation, you can just, you know, print 1 million copies in a day, or whether you can broadcast your message to millions of people with radio sets or TV sets. The thing about those machines, though, is they're very expensive, so only a few people can have access to them. And there are limits to how many of them there can be. Something like radio, you know, there's only a certain amount of bandwidth. There's only a certain number of radio stations you can have. And so we end up with this very centralized media system, which has, yes, this small priesthood of journalists and politicians and businessmen who have access to it. Then what happens at the end of the 20th century is that the internet makes reaching a very large audience of millions cheap again. So it has been very expensive for a very long time because you had to like buy all these printing presses and radio towers and establish a media empire. And then suddenly, with things like blogs and social media, you can, in theory, reach an audience of millions of people for little or no cost. And so that does away with this sort of short-term constraint that we had and the broadcast era and all the business models that arose around it. And that's why we see the media industry in such a mess, you know, the music industry undermined by the internet, the newspaper industry undermined by the internet and so on. Essentially, they were built on a business model that was based on short-term scarcity and short-term monopoly. And the internet has undone that. So I'm trying to show this larger shape to the history of media. And a consequence of all of this is that the social media we have now is very, very similar to the social media that we had before the mass media era. So the mass media era is the anomaly, the blip that has now come to an end. But what that means is if we rediscover this ancient social media that was going on before the 19th century, we can actually learn a lot about the social media we're using today. It's not unprecedented. It's actually a reversion to the mean, but going back to the way things used to be. And as a result, we can learn from the way people dealt with it in the past.
And yet, on the other hand, as you referred to journalists, they were part of the priesthood. I have to say, I kind of like that idea. I've never thought of myself as being part of the priesthood. And, you know, you're part of that priesthood, too. And, you know, you work for The Economist. The question, of course, is whether we're losing something once we don't rely so much on professionals like journalists who are trained to do this, trained to write well, to disseminate the news with a critical eye. What do you think?
Well, yes, I'm a member of the priesthood, and so are you, and the irony is we're talking about this on the radio, which is all part of this. But I think we have to recognise we're entering a new world here. Broadcast isn't going to go away. Broadcast overshadowed social media for the mass media era, and now they're essentially on pretty much an even footing, I think. But we're seeing the balance, this new hybrid of mass media and social media emerging, and we're all trying to work out how to do it. And so we see mass media organisations trying to work out how to use social media to their best advantage. And so, you know, that's one of the things I'm responsible for at The Economist is, you know, our use of digital media and digital platforms. So that's something that, you know, we're trying to do our best to figure out. We also see social media being used actually in rather a sort of broadcasty way. If you think about how Barack Obama or Lady Gaga use Twitter, they're not actually chatting with their friends on it. They are tweeting millions of people at once. It's very much a broadcast model. So what we see happening now, in fact, is an emergence of a hybrid. And the net result of this is there will be fewer professional journalists in future. I think particularly in the US, there are probably, you know, the number that we had during the mass media boom. I don't know if we're going to have that many in the future.
Tom Standage is the author of Writing on the Wall, Social Media of the First 2,000 Years. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program, How to Read a Book. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Special thanks to special guest engineers Brittany True and Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.